This is the Sunshine Economy, the business of better, the self-improvement industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. How's that New Year's resolution working out for you? Are you sticking to the exercise promise? Maybe spending more time with the family and friends, less time with your smartphone? Have you made the changes you promised yourself you were going to make in the new year? Well, this is where the self-help business comes in. Improving ourselves, stopping bad habits, or changing how we live, how we eat, how we work, even how we sleep, how we date, how we look, how we exercise, you name it, it's a multi-billion dollar per year industry. It's an industry that asks of us,
tell me what you don't like about yourself.
Recognize that question? It was central to the television show Nip Tuck that ran on the cable network FX last decade. And appropriately enough, this fictional show about two self-obsessed plastic surgeons was based here in South Florida in Miami. Now, it sounds cynical to say the business of better is about what you don't like about yourself, doesn't it? But conversely, if we were happy with everything that we did and everything that we are, there wouldn't really be much of a self-help, self-improvement industry. You may not recognize the name Dr. Arthur Agatston. He's a clinical cardiologist who has spent his medical career fighting heart disease. He's a medical director of wellness and prevention for Baptist Health South Florida. You probably know his diet, though, the South Beach diet. He joins us via Skype from his offices in Miami Beach. Dr. Agatston, welcome to the Sunshine Economy.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
Does the self-help business rest on what we don't like about ourselves?
I think it does to a large extent, although more and more it is people who just, not so much what they don't like about themselves, but they want to feel better. I think, or obviously what's happened to the U.S. due to the diet and lack of exercise, the fact we're sitting over computers all day, has had effects that we're just beginning to understand. And orientation is not so much fixing what's wrong, it's an aspiration of optimal health. Mm-hmm. And we know so much more than we did 10, 20 years ago on what has happened to the United States, why we've become so fat and sick, and what we can do about it.
This started, your South Beach diet started with your medical patients here in South Florida in the 1990s. It led to the first book in 2003. It's an ultra-competitive business, this diet business. Why do you think the South Beach diet continues to survive a decade plus on?
Well, you know, when we started the diet, it was really an academic exercise. I was watching my patients get fatter and sicker on the nationally recommended low-fat, high-carb diet. And there was a lot of new information about the importance of fiber, of good carbs and nutrient dense carbs, of good fats, glycemic index. And then it was the argument was low fat versus low carb. Mm-hmm. We said it's not the relative amounts of fats and carbs, it's the quality. It's the good fats, good carbs, lean source of protein, plenty of fiber. And those principles have stood the test of time. They're now in all the national guidelines, and every new book, diet book, is going to somehow really reflect those same guidelines. So we were the gold standard. We did studies. It was scientifically based. In fact, it all started really accidentally. We presented studies on our diet, and the local media asked us to put South Florida on it, and that's how it started.
You're saying that it wasn't your idea to put South Florida on it, that it was a mediated idea.
Well, we were presenting what happened. We decided on the good fats, good carbs. We tried it in our patients at Mount Sinai at the time. I was director of cardiac rehab. We had great success. We started to report our success. We did a clinical trial that we reported at a national meeting, and it was Channel 10 PLG that said, please, let's put South Florida on the diet. It was called the Modified Carbohydrate Diet. And it was all academic. But when they did that, it switched from academic to, I guess, commercial. That's when we adopted the name South Beach, and they won their sweeps, and kind of the rest is history.
Do you send any residuals back to the commercial TV station now, 10, 12 years plus on?
It was Christy Krueger back then. And sure. Then actually, when the book came out, it was the NBC affiliate and Diana Gonzalez who did a great story that went national. So South Florida media was very helpful in kicking it off. And I was surprised. It happened completely accidentally.
Yeah, and so were those South Florida patients, of course, that you treated back in the 90s with this diet. Dr. Arthur Agustin is the founder of the South Beach Diet, a Miami Beach-based cardiologist. Let us know your experiences with dieting here in the Sunshine Economy. Send us a tweet at WLRN. Use that hashtag Sunshine Economy. Join the live online web chat right now, curated by Elaine Chen at WLRN.org. Forget about telling us what you don't like about yourself. Tell us how successful, perhaps, you hope to be with a New Year's diet. I want to ask you, Dr. Agustin, is your competition in terms of the business of the South Beach diet, and I know that you sold the brand, which we'll talk about in a second, but is the competition for the diet, the business of the South Beach diet, the industrialized food industry?
No, I guess it's other diets. I mean, Weight Watchers is the big one, and others which tend to be more quick weight loss. We think of ourselves as the only true lifestyle brand. Our books have talked about exercise, core exercise, interval exercise, as well as diet. And we've kept up with the times in our latest book on gluten. Yep. I think is really paradigm shifting, even though it's a case where the public has been on top of it, but physicians have been way behind. So we really change with the times, and we think we're the only true lifestyle brand that's about lifestyle rather than just weight loss.
The idea of gluten, though, your comment is interesting because it really has changed the source of the conversation in the medical community regarding diet and health from the medical professional, forgive me, doctor, but a physician like yourself directing that conversation, and now the patient's really becoming the advocate for what's healthy for them, what feels good to them, and they know best when they feel good with what they're eating.
Yeah, I mean, we have examples. And in fact, one woman that became my patient, she was diagnosed with anorexia, and everybody told her she was anorexic. And we have actually several people like this. And she discovered herself about gluten, took herself off gluten. And now this is a good 5 years later. She's healthy, feels wonderful. And a good percentage of anorexics, if they go off gluten, are cured. And this is just not yet known out there. You know, diet, big pharma, if it's not a drug, they don't support research in nutrition. And that's who teaches a lot of physicians. So this is an example where the public has really been way out in front of the medical community.
So you're saying the pharmaceutical industry isn't engaged in healthy eating, and that has some economic consequences for those for-profit companies. And one of those consequences is the lack of real robust education on the part of the medical community.
Yes, so much education, both the research is initiated with money from Big Pharma, and also the education of physicians supporting meetings. And if the treatment doesn't include a pill, you often just don't get the funding and the backing. And celiac centers, that's the extreme form of gluten problems, they are having a lot of trouble surviving financially.
Dr. Arthur Agustin, the founder of the South Beach Diet, Miami Beach-based clinical cardiologist with us here on the Sunshine Economy. It's the business of better, the self-improvement industry in South Florida. Let us know your story on Twitter at WLRN. Use that hashtag Sunshine Economy, your New Year's resolution. If you've been able to follow through with it here a few weeks into the new year, and the live web chat as well online at WLRN.com. diet.org. You talk about the role of the pharmaceutical industry, which is highly regulated, of course, Dr. Agustin. Let me ask you about regulation in terms of the diet industry, because federal regulators, the Federal Trade Commission, and others have cracked down on some diet claims recently by companies. A firm called Sensa, which sold a dietary powder with the promise, quote, sprinkle, eat, and lose weight, end quote, caught the eye of federal regulators recently. Does there need to be more regulation of diet claims?
That's a tough one. I can tell you one experience we had early on. One of our major points was that, of course, there are good fats and bad fats, good carbs, bad carbs. And so we were touting good fats, omega-3 fish oils, olive oils, great evidence that they are good for us. Not all fats are the same. And when we were involved with Kraft at that point, they said we couldn't say good fats.
Right.
And if I was speaking at a meeting that was associated with Kraft, I couldn't say it. And I said, that's crazy. There are good fats. Let me say it. Let's take them on. This is the truth. But boy, their legal departments were so scared of what they could say. And in general, national guidelines and where we are, we have this in our cardiac guidelines, are often years behind where cutting edge is. And in fact, one of the recent controversies about how much gluten constitutes gluten-free. Mm-hmm. I mean, all foods have a little bit of gluten. And I'm glad there are national guidelines on that. So they can cut both ways. A lot of the obesity epidemic was due to the government's promulgating low fat, high carb, like all fat was bad and all carbs were good. And we absolutely know that to be wrong. So often by the time the regulations get there, we're already on to new science. So it's a two-edged sword.
You're holding an event on Saturday in Davie that you call Gluten Sensitivity, America's Most Under-Recognized Medical Problem. You don't call it a diet problem or a health problem, a medical problem. What are the consequences of this unrecognized medical problem, do you think, in the health and wellness of Americans?
Yeah, well, and one of the issues with gluten sensitivity, the extreme gluten problem is celiac disease, for which there are good tests or blood tests, and then you can do a small bowel biopsy. Gluten sensitivity right now, there's no, although people claim it, the experts feel there is no reliable test. And you can have everything from being told of rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and psoriasis. We've had patients who actually have all of that for 20, 30 years, be miserable and be cured when you go off gluten. To the other extreme is Djokovic, the tennis star, who just couldn't win 5 set matches until he got off gluten. He had a little asthma that got better. He could focus better. So it's a big spectrum, but I believe it's affecting close to half of the people in your audience.
Wow, this is significant. But if the food industry gets more engaged, the pharmaceutical industry gets more engaged, and the regulators get more engaged, could this have the potential of, yes, more enlightenment and more acknowledgement and more treatment, but also higher prices for food?
Well, absolutely. But I think as they get better at it, the prices initially go up, but then they come down. And by the way, the other thing that we're discovering through all this, a medical school classmate of mine, Dr. Marty Blaser, who's recently a chief of medicine up at NYU, has shown that it's abuse of antibiotics, talk about the pharmaceutical industry, that may be causing the current epidemic of gluten problems. Mm. We're killing off healthy bacteria in our guts that help us digest gluten. We're not digesting it well. It's toxic to the small intestine and is causing all of these problems. And I believe that's a really big part of it. And while more research is needed, we are using much too many antibiotics. And for your listeners, don't just pop a Z-Pak every time you have a little bit of cold. It's knocking out or a healthy bacteria.
Dr. Arthur Agustin, the founder of the South Beach Diet, you sold the brand to a New York-based private equity firm named MidOcean Partners in 2011. I imagine that was quite a windfall for you.
Well, we're working with them. We're part owners, and it's really to bring the brand to the next level, both with foods. I always felt that to be successful with a new food product, we have to make convenient food healthier and healthier food more convenient.
How good is business right now, Dr. Agustin, for the brand?
The business, it's going up all the time. We have our next quarterly board meeting, and we're expanding in different areas. So again, because we're really a lifestyle brand and not just a diet brand, and it's about not just weight loss but really feeling better, we think we're in a unique position, and we're still working to get the word out there. And we have, we do a lot of research. We have a national research team, both in lifestyle and prevention. We still publish a lot of papers, and we're moving the science forward.
Finally, Dr. Agustin, what was on your breakfast menu this morning?
A 3-egg veggie omelet.
With yolk or without yolk?
With the yolk.
Okay, with the yolk. Dr. Arthur Agustin, Miami Beach cardiologist and founder of the South Beach Diet, with us here on the Sunshine Economy. Thank you, Doctor. Still to come on the program, getting off the sidelines of life and into personal coaching.
In a weak economy where there aren't that many good jobs to be had, things like personal coaching become an attractive job option.
This is the Sunshine Economy, the business of better, the self-improvement industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Let us know how those New Year's resolutions to improve yourself, your life, your lot, your community are going on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy or online at WLRN.org. Look for the Sunshine Economy tab. Well, the self-improvement industry can be awfully lucrative. Last year, U.S. consumers spent over $11 billion on a range of products, audio products, books, seminars, coaching, all aimed at making some part of their lives better. There are coaches for fitness, finances, even the affairs of the heart. Here's the Miami Herald's Karen Rundlett.
People come to South Florida to live the good life, whether it's for opportunity or for the sunshine. So this is a place particularly well-suited to the self-improvement industry. Across the country, the particular field of one-on-one coaching has grown exponentially since the beginning of the recession in 2007. Executive coaching, life coaching, personal fitness trainers. Dan Silverman grew his coaching business out of something he was doing for free at bars all over South Florida. Silverman used to get groups of friends together to practice meeting women. Most of the guys were quieter types, guys who found the South Beach scene intimidating.
And because people were lining up to get advice from me, someone suggested I should charge for it, so I did.
Silverman started MiamiDatingCoach.com about 7 years ago. Howard was a client.
I had friends that were girls, but, generally that, pretty much as far as it went. I moved from San Diego to Weston, and I found that, women generally tend to be a little bit more closed off to meeting people outside of their social circle.
MiamiDatingCoach.com offers packages for men and women that run anywhere from $200 for phone sessions to $12,000 for matchmaking services and an extensive dating life makeover. That could mean anything from cleaning up your Facebook profile to fixing up your apartment. Silverman also coaches clients on what to talk about, what to wear, and where to go on these dates. Like this cheese shop?
Places like this. You're actually able to walk around and try different cheeses for free, which is really good on your budget. And it's an activity you can do with someone, getting to know someone and chatting, and even gives you really cool opportunities where you can feed the other person.
But his job isn't all goat cheese and grapes. Silverman spends many hours in front of the computer.
online content management, SEO, social media. I have my own YouTube channel that I have.
Silverman's coaching business is one of the many that grew in the midst of a recession.
Well, in a weak economy where there aren't that many good jobs to be had, things like personal coaching become an attractive job option.
John De La Rosa studies the self-improvement industry at Market Data Enterprises.
It's very easy to get into the business, and there isn't much of a financial investment involved.
De La Rosa says the best customers in the self-improvement industry are affluent women in their 40s who live in U.S. coastal cities, places like Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Boca. Top-tier coaches can turn it into a six-figure gig and maybe even a reality show.
That's cool.
Do you want me to see if she likes you enough for you to go ask her out again?
Before Patty Stanger was the millionaire matchmaker on Bravo TV, she graduated from UM and worked for a dating service in South Florida.
He just wasn't for me. Nobody's for her. Nobody can ride that ride.
Today, coaching is like the Wild Wild West. Very few of them actually go and get certifications and learn and build a methodology and understand and implement a methodology.
It's not always about getting the girl. Very often, it's about getting the gig and doing it well. Martin Echevarria left his corporate job to run his own consulting business called Coherence. Right now, 20% of his business comes from executive coaching. CEOs and other leaders often get coaching bought and paid for by their corporations. Companies like American Express, Verizon, the healthcare district of Palm Beach County, they've all paid Echevarria to work with some of their high-potential leaders. Folks who are technically exceptional, but who may have a ways to go as a manager. The people skills.
The soft skills are what everybody talks about. They call them soft, but really they're hard. What's the skill of telling somebody that you disagree with them, that things need to change, that you need to hold a certain space for critical conversation?
Every famous athlete, every famous performer has somebody who's a coach.
Google's executive chairman, Eric Schmidt, has said getting a coach was some of the best advice he ever got. But he resented the idea when it was first suggested to him.
I don't need a coach. I'm an established CEO. Why would I need a coach? Is something wrong?
The explosion of coaching as a new income stream makes sense. It's a personal service that can't be automated or outsourced internationally. The question of whether it can become a sturdy middle-class career is still up in the air. But in an economy where people are looking for stability, it is no surprise that they're trying to turn their passion into profits. From the WLRN Miami Herald newsroom, I'm Karen Rundlett.
Still to come on the program, forget about working harder. It's all about working smarter.
In my mind, productivity means getting a lot accomplished. It does not mean spending more time on something.
This is the Sunshine Economy, the business of better, the self-improvement industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. The year is still young, but what have you accomplished so far?
Let's see. In the last week, I've published three editorial pieces. One was on tax reform in an online service.
This is Bob Posen. He's been the boss at two mutual fund giants, Fidelity and MFS Investment Management, responsible for hundreds of billions of dollars of Americans' investments and retirements.
On reforming the Chinese pension fund.
He has taught at Harvard and MIT. He's worked on presidential commissions, nonprofits, sits on corporate boards of directors. He's written textbooks, countless articles, and six books. His latest is Extreme Productivity. He was visiting South Florida recently for management meetings of a company whose board he belongs, Nielsen, the TV ratings company. For a guy so busy, we started with the question, what does it mean to be productive?
Well, that's actually a very good question, and I think it's at the core of a lot of people's confusion. In my mind, productivity means getting a lot accomplished. It does not mean spending more time on something. You can spend a lot of time, as you know, on trying to put together a piece for your radio show, and maybe it takes 10 hours and it's not so great, or sometimes in 2 or 3 hours you can put it together and it's really great. So the key is what you're actually achieving, and that depends on what your objectives are. So in my mind, you have to be very clear about what it is that are your objectives. And then second of all, put together a set of metrics measuring how do we know at the end of the day, the week, the month, whatever the time frame is, on whether we've achieved what we want to in terms of these objectives. And it's putting down the metrics that really gives it a concreteness and a reality that's very helpful to people.
Some of those measurements for certain objectives can be easy, right? I want to lose 10 pounds. I want to exercise more. I want to get more sleep. I want to eat better. Those kinds of metrics are pretty easy, be it a grocery list or the time your alarm goes off and the time you go to bed at night. But what about some of those more difficult metrics and more, shall I say, kind of foggy objectives? I want to be a better person. I want to live a happier life, those kinds of things.
Well, let's take two different sorts of examples. One is, say, in a business context, say your boss and your team's getting together to talk about improving customer service. Mm-hmm. So there's a pretty vague objective. So I recommend that people think hard about what would be the metrics for success. And that actually will help them refine their objectives a lot more. For instance, are they talking about reducing the number of seconds that a phone rings before the customer service person answers it? Or are they talking about making more client calls so that they get out on the street or, you know, get out in terms of meeting these people? Or are they just talking about actually processing more transactions quickly and more accurately? So that's how you take a vague objective like customer service and you make it more metrics. In terms of your own life, it's more complicated. I mean, for example, suppose you decide that you want to improve your relationship with your teenage son or daughter. So that's a very complicated question to begin with. But it depends on what exactly the teenage son or daughter would like you to do more. Mm-hmm. For example, you might decide together that you would attend more of their sports games. You might decide, on the other hand, that you'd attend less of their social activities like dances or things like that. You might decide that you would, once a week, go out and have breakfast together and have some quality time. You might decide that you'd read a book together. So I think what's good about metrics is that they really force you to take these vague objectives and really have a discussion with the relevant people and figure out what would constitute success.
There's one commonality in the objectives and the metrics: time.
Correct.
Two things I know about time, Bob. It runs in one direction and at one speed.
I'm afraid you're correct about that one.
And it becomes a matter of time management, organizational skills, priority setting. All of that gets into being more productive, doesn't it?
Correct.
And that means the ability to say no.
Correct. That's a very important ability.
Yeah. To say no to your boss, to say no to your spouse, to say maybe no to your kids.
Yeah. I think, first of all, you have to be clear about what your objectives are, what your personal objectives are, what your professional objectives are. And second of all, you have to be prepared to be active. I find that most people go through the day passively. It's a typical complaint that people say is that, well, I worked real hard at work. I was there at office till late, but I don't feel like I accomplished anything. What they really mean is they were always responding to somebody else's emails and phone calls, and they never did what they thought was important. And then another thing is to have a sense of priorities, especially when you deal with interpersonal things. So it's okay to say, I believe, to your boss to have a discussion about, I have quality dinner time with my family from, say, 6:30 to 8:30. So I'm really not going to be answering your phone calls or emails during that time. Sometimes people will have bosses who will say, I want you to do 7 things by, you know, the end of the week. And you know that's not possible. So, I mean, again, having a good conversation with your boss is saying, look, give me some sense of priorities. I'm not sure I can get all these done. Which are the ones that really need to be done first? And if you really want all 7 done, shouldn't we talk about bringing in some more resources?
Priorities and time begin afresh every morning. Sometimes they begin before the alarm bell goes off and we wake up anxious even prior to when we wanted to wake up. What's morning like in the Posen household for you to become productive?
Well, the night before, I do go through my schedule for the next day and set it up. And I try to have a two-sided schedule. The left side has the normal schedule of people, meetings, phone
their
calls,
appointments,
et cetera.
The time they're
but
at,
the
yeah.
right side of the schedule says what I'm trying to accomplish here.
Hmm. What was on the right side for this interview?
The right side for this interview was to make sure that we talked about my book, Personal Productivity, so that your readers would have at least an incentive to go out and buy the
there
book.
There you go. Sure,
It's close to a bestseller, but you know, having spent the time to write the book, I really like people to
your
read
objective,
it.
Your end goal here is to get it into that bestseller list. Noted, yeah. Bob. So yeah. after then, the night before.
Okay, and then in the morning, I get up, and I guess I call this try to routinize the routine. Hmm. And I basically wear pretty much the same thing every day. And I noticed that President Obama did the same thing. He has 5 winter suits, 5 summer suits, and they're all blue. So he doesn't want to think about it. He just puts on his suit, and then he's going. And so to me, at least in my profession, that's okay. I'm not that keen on how I dress, and as long as I'm presentable, that's okay. So that's what I do. I lay it all out. I have these suits, and I don't spend any time or energy thinking about it.
But those kinds of decisions, what tie to wear, what right. color shoes to wear, what do I have for breakfast today, does that really make you less productive if you go through that exercise every morning?
Well, I think it does take time and energy if you do. And I guess, say, something like your wardrobe. Some people might spend as much as an hour or so figuring out what their wardrobe is. Now, of course, in some professions, that might be critical.
Sure.
And therefore, it's not just what you happen to wear. In, of course, to do a radio show, it doesn't matter exactly what you're wearing. And, you know, as a professor at Harvard and now at MIT Sloan, you know, the quality of your dressing is not really.
I did notice no elbow patches, though, on the blazer over there.
Well,
not yet.
Not yet. So I think actually, if you put all these little things together, there are maybe a half an hour here and a half an hour there, and it does take time and energy. And so I think that unless, for instance, what you wear as dressing is really important to your career, then having this approach is perfectly reasonable.
I want to ask you finally, who's responsible for one's productivity?
Well, again, that's a very challenging question, an important question. I think first and foremost, you yourself are responsible, and that you have a series of decisions that you make, both in terms of your career and in terms of your day-to-day living. And so if you choose to be passive and just let things come as they do, then the chances of your being productive relative to your goals aren't very good, because you're basically accepting other people's goals.
Bob Posen, corporate leader, university lecturer, writer, author of Extreme Productivity. Now, I do have to say, it was refreshing to see, after we finished our conversation, the first thing Bob did was reach for the BlackBerry to check his messages. All right, still to come here on the Sunshine Economy, one plastic surgeon operating at the intersection of science and religion.
Basically, what I do is psychiatry with a knife. You know, it's about making you feel better about your body.
This is the Sunshine Economy, the business of better, the self-improvement industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson.
In some cities, keeping up with the Joneses means, you know, driving a Mercedes. In other cities, it may be having a Brazilian butt lift.
That's Dr. Michael Salzhauer. He's a plastic surgeon in Bay Harbor Islands. He has another name, though, too.
Yeah, they call me Dr. Schnoz.
Yeah, Dr. Schnoz. Dr. Salzhauer does not shy away from that nickname. He's proud of it, and makes no excuses for stoking his reputation as a plastic surgeon in looks-obsessed South Florida who isn't afraid of stereotypes. This is from a music video by the Orthodox Jewish punk band called The Groggers. Dr. Salzhauer participated in the video back in early 2012. But she don't want what I am. She says you gotta be like you can. He offered a free nose job to the band, and the lead singer took him up on it. Doctors' groups and religious organizations condemned the video, its message, and Dr. Salzhauer's participation as depicting negative stereotypes.
Everything you wanted, I'll be everything you need. Watch the passerbys flash their eyes when we walk down the street.
Today, Salzhauer laughs off his critics as humorless as his plastic surgery business continues growing.
This one block alone has four or five plastic surgeons. They call it Silicone Alley. So it's booming, and it always has been for the last decade. So,
what's your patient bookings look like for the first quarter?
Busy, very busy. Year over year, we're up. And we've been up pretty much since we opened the practice, with a slight dip during the beginning of the recession. But as prices adjusted for that blip, the volume has been very high.
And what's bringing the volume through? What kinds of work are people electing to have done? Not the emergency cases, but the elective cases.
Sure. Yeah, and I should say that 99% of my practice is elective cosmetic surgery. In the last 2 years, and specifically in the last year, the Brazilian butt lift operation, believe it or not, has become the most popular operation in South Florida from a growth perspective. No pun intended. After that, breast augmentation, liposuction, tummy tucks, and nose jobs.
The Brazilian procedure, what do you think is driving that interest?
It's a number of factors. There's a cultural shift towards larger booties. All across the cultural spectrum, the heavily Latino influence down here in South Florida specifically, but we have patients flying in from all over the country and all over the world. I mean, literally from Kazakhstan, from Australia, from England, to have this operation. And we've become known as sort of a mecca here in South Florida for that particular procedure.
In that particular Brazilian procedure, it's more than just Latinos that are asking for it, right?
Absolutely.
Is it solely females?
No, about 5% of the patients are men for that operation. No, it covers all races, I guess all countries, all over the world. It's a global phenomenon. In fact, last week I had a surgeon from China come in. She's a fellow from China, where they don't do this operation yet. And she learned about the operation, came in, and I actually performed it on her, videotaped the procedure, and she's going to go back to China, where her boss is, you know, one of the chiefs of plastic surgery there, and they're going to perform it there. So, when you said culturally speaking, it's a global phenomenon.
Is that a high margin operation as you look at the other elective procedures you offer?
It's one of the more profitable operations because there's very little, you know, material costs, so to speak. You know, like a breast augmentation, the implants themselves cost upwards of $1,000 a pair. And there's a lot of surgeons everywhere that do breast augmentation, so the prices are very. That's a relatively low margin operation, but the Brazilian butt lift, since you're using the patient's own fat, it's just about time and your expertise, and that's it. So yeah, it's a high margin procedure.
So what's the most popular procedure that you do that's in your patient book right now?
Well, liposuction is the operation that is most common, mainly because it's one of those things that people undergoing plastic surgery add on at the end. It's like when you're going through the drive-thru at McDonald's, you say, would you like fries with that? So in plastic surgery, it's would you like liposuction with that? And almost everybody has some fat somewhere that they want removed. But then after that, it's a horse race between Brazilian butt lift and breast augmentation, and then tummy tuck, rhinoplasty, et cetera.
What do you think drives your business, drives the patients to come in for the consultation and then go through with this elective procedure?
Well, I mean, everybody wants to improve the way they look and feel about themselves. It's about self-esteem. I tell my family, basically what I do is psychiatry with a knife. You know, it's about making you feel better about your body. I have five little kids at home, and I try to explain to them what I do for a living. And I say, your body is kind of like a spacesuit, you know, and your soul is kind of what the person inside the spacesuit. And if your spacesuit doesn't fit right or feel right, I kind of fix the spacesuit to make it match the inner person.
Using that metaphor, you fix your spacesuit.
Yeah.
You didn't do the surgery, but you had someone else do it for you. So
right,
you
yeah.
are a not only practitioner of plastic surgery, you've also been a patient.
I'm a true believer. I'm a true believer in plastic surgery. Yeah. I've had a chin augmentation, a rhinoplasty, and it changed my life. I mean, it certainly changed my self-esteem. When you don't feel good about the person you see in the mirror, beauty really is a matter of millimeters here and millimeters there. So it's tiny little nuances and nudges that can make somebody go from being sort of average to being very attractive or not attractive to being very attractive. So, but I think, you know, if I psychoanalyze myself a bit here, I kind of always had some issues in that department, and then it's probably what drove me into the specialty to begin with.
Did the scalpel solve those issues, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it solved those issues. I mean, I still have to pay the mortgage and tuition and, you know, all the other things in life. But at least that's one hang-up that you can kind of cross off the bucket list. Mm. Yeah. And that's what it is for most people. You know, it doesn't solve everything, obviously, but it does help.
At this point in our interview, I should mention on Dr. Salzhauer's desk sits a silicone breast implant and a volume of the Babylonian Talmud. Maybe they're props, I don't know. But Dr. Salzhauer, Dr. Schnaz, is an Orthodox Jew.
How has your religion informed your scientific career?
Well, that's... I could talk for literally hours about that. It has impact... As a religious person... It sort of influences every aspect of your life, from the minute you wake up to the minute you go to sleep. You know, living a God-centered life and feeling like all your actions are being weighed and monitored and judged by a higher power definitely influences all the choices you make and decisions you do in every aspect.
As somebody who is changing nature for a living, being a plastic surgeon, how does that conform with your otherwise religious beliefs?
So people often come to me if they don't know that much about Jewish philosophy and Jewish religion and Orthodox Judaism, and they say, well, doesn't it say in the Bible that you can't change your body? But it doesn't say that anywhere in the Bible, you know. In fact, circumcision is one of the first commandments given to Abraham by God. So clearly there is, at least in that way, God gives his blessing to changing the body. And in everything in nature, we're born naked and hungry and cold. If we didn't build houses out of wood and trees and, make fire, we wouldn't survive. So it's not like God gives us everything, fully formed. And our body is no different. From a religious perspective, Orthodox Judaism does not say everybody can have plastic surgery for any reason. But if the reason is legitimate, if it's affecting your self-esteem to a significant degree, if it's affecting a girl's or a boy's ability to find a mate, to create marital peace between husband and wife, there are religious sanctions, even from the highest rabbinic authorities, to do so, as long as the physical risk is not too extreme. I would say the same should apply for all people. If you're considering plastic surgery, you need to really look and see what the motivations are and if the risks are worth the benefits. In most cases, it is. In most cases, the benefits far outweigh the risks.
Both religion and science are about improving one's life or improving one's surroundings, certainly. Which one do you think has improved your life most and for the better?
Well, without a doubt, religion gives me purpose and meaning. And so it sort of is the underlying drive behind everything that I do. It's, living with my wife, raising a family, like you said, trying to make the world a better place. And science is more of a tool to achieve, like you said, the goals that religion have, which is to make the world a better place.
Dr. Michael Salzhauer, you can see a picture of him at his desk in his office on our web chat at WLRN.org. Still to come on our program, our self-image as South Floridians.
So maybe our first goal could be to change some of the old superficial features the world has seen so far.
This is the Sunshine Economy, the business of better, the self-improvement industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. How do you plan on improving yourself or helping others get better? Sure, most of us could stand to lose a few pounds. We could be more patient, especially when we're driving here in South Florida. We could read more and we could text less.
Hi, my name is Galen Grigas from Hollywood, Florida. I stopped letting people rent space in my head. I stop my obsessive thinking on negative situations, and I just handle it. Or I handle the situation in person and then just move on.
Stop letting people rent space in your head is the advice of Galen Grigas. She tells us she's stopping what she calls the negative movie in her head and letting go of what she can't control. Well, South Florida has its own self-image issue. It's been 30 years since Crockett and Tubbs first donned those linen and pastels, but the impression of South Florida in general, Miami particularly, from the outside our region, sometimes even within our own communities, really hasn't changed much. So we brought in a certified life coach, clinical psychologist, and trained psychoanalyst, Dr. Brett Burling of the Coral Gables-based Go 10 Living, to help us understand our image issues.
Hello, Dr. Burling. My name is Miami, Florida. I need a life coach. I feel that I have some issues with my self-image and the image that I would like to project to the world.
Yeah, hello, Miami. And how do you think the world sees you?
I think people see me as beautiful, a bit shallow, but sunny and fun. Wonderful beaches, good restaurants, great shopping malls, plastic surgery, sex, and drugs. They also perceive me as having too much traffic with aggressive and impatient drivers. I don't like giving this impression when I'm so much more. I have so many positive aspects that I don't know how to express.
Okay, let's take a look at some of them and set some goals for you to show this side of you. What are your positive aspects?
I'm multicultural, cosmopolitan, and I have a serious intellectual and cultural background. I'm very sophisticated. I have so many different nationalities within me, bringing their own languages and culture. I'm music, art, opera, film festivals. I'm championship sports. I'm international finance and a force for global trade. I'm complex and profound. I have several great universities and world-renowned medical facilities. I have all that, but when people meet me, somehow they don't see this.
I wonder what keeps you from shining and projecting all these wonderful qualities that any city in the world would envy.
Maybe I'm afraid when people see me, they will be disappointed if they discover that I have a soul.
You know, when you have created an image, it's not easy to change that perception, but it is possible. So maybe our first goal could be to change some of the old superficial features the world has seen so far. How would you go about that?
Well, maybe I could get the Real Housewives of Miami to go to a bookstore.
Mm-hmm. Spending time with friends is vital to living a happy life. And just take time to be kind to yourself and others. Who is it?
It's Fort Lauderdale. I'm here to talk about living in someone else's shadow.
We need to keep calm and be kind. Regardless if you have a gym membership you hardly use or go to self-help seminars, it's all in the pursuit of being better, no matter what life brings us. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Economy. Thanks for listening.
Look for the silver lining whene'er a cloud appears in the blue. Remember somewhere the sun is shining, and so the right thing to do is make it shine for you, a heart full of joy and gladness will always banish sadness and strife. So always look for the silver lining and try to find the sunny side of life.